back on Canucks Central. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah here in the Mobile Kintech Studio. Canucks and Calgary Flames here tonight. We'll bring you the pregame show coming up after 6 o'clock. The Hall of Fame induction speeches went down last night. A great class in 2024, as there always is. But one name, a former Vancouver Canuck, remains outside of the Hall, despite many calls for him to be in, and that is Alex McGillney, our next guest. Tim Graham from The Athletic Buffalo, his latest on maybe some of the reasons why Almo hasn't got the call to the Hall yet. Thanks for this, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for making time. I was reading through your piece last night, and it's fascinating because it feels as though, and I've been a part of this too, looking back on McGillney's career and just how prolific he was offensively, like, how is this guy not yet in? And I haven't heard a lot of arguments as to why not. And through your reporting, you found quite a few reasons why, and maybe they were pretty obvious there for us to see and remember about Almo's career. What did you find when going through this process and doing this piece?
Well, I covered the NHL towards the end of his career. Now, I wasn't the Sabres beat writer when he was playing for the Sabres. I covered the Sabres for the Buffalo News from 2000 to 2007, and he was still in the league, and his reputation was pretty clear and obvious, and we knew about it. And I've just found it fascinating. It's been a phenomenon the last maybe, I don't know, 3-5 years of people looking at his case at through the numbers, and of course his very brave and significant decision to defect from the Soviet Union and really pave the way for a lot of other Russian players in the NHL, a revolution really, that people looked at that and says, now how, why, it's got to be a conspiracy, we can't figure it out, this is just unknown. We can't. It's perplexing. It's confusing. How is this even possible? And every time I'd read one of those stories, I'd, throw my head to the ceiling and say, we know exactly why he's not in the Hall of Fame. And then after a while, I think I saw one too many of them. And it was over the summer. In fact, there was a local TV reporter who tweeted about Pat LaFontaine's number 16 being up in the KeyBank Center rafters. And he was just asking a question like, should his 16 be retired? The conversation immediately turned to Alexander McGillney's 89 must be in the rafters. It's a crime. And I said, all right, this is getting to be to the point where it's only been 20 years. He's been out of the league. It's not like he was 50 years ago. And I told myself, all right, I'm going to write the story that at least explains, so that way we don't have this willful ignorance or obtuse approach to why Alexander McGillney's not in. I believe he should be in. I'm not making the case that he doesn't belong. I'm just, this piece was just to say, okay, let's just for the record, go back to his career and get it through the words of the people who played with him, the people who covered him, the selectors who are on this committee who are not allowed to talk but have written books and have written things about Alexander McGillney. Their opinions are available if you go looking for them, even though they've signed these non-disclosure agreements in this clandestine process that is the Hockey Hall of Fame selection. It's there. And so that was just my motivation here. Was let's put it all in one place. Let's find out what the people's feelings were, the people, these gatekeepers, mm-hmm. His Hall of Fame teammates, Hall of Fame coaches, people who were on the selection committee. Let's get their feelings out here in one place so that way you can at least get a glimpse into how they're thinking, why they think this way, and not pretend like it's a mystery that will never be solved.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where I'm with you. I want to see Alex McGillney in the Hall of Fame, and I think the courage he showed to defect the Soviet Union at the time and the bravery he had to go through what he did, I think all those things do matter, and especially everything he has accomplished. But you're right that there is a checkered past, and the player and the people that knew him the best are some of the ones that haven't been the biggest supporters. I think you outlined that really well. Like, he's a guy who got traded to the Canucks 2 years after scoring 76 goals. I mean, in today's world, a player is not getting traded after scoring 76 goals for like a decade. And when that happened, and there's probably a reason why that happened.
Yeah, the Sabres had to get rid of him because he wanted out, but also because they were tired of him. I mean, and I think that's what happened with every stop he's been. Most of the stops, maybe not Toronto. He had mellowed a bit. I think people knew what Alexander Mogilny was about. I even referenced it in my story that by the time he got to Toronto, Matt Sundin found him amusing. His refusal to work out, you know, had become kind of something that the guys chuckled about. But earlier in his career, when he's not rehabbing his injuries, when he's refusing to show up to physical therapy and things like that, I mean, when that was it plays into it. And, you know, I use the phrase sporting sins, especially I think in hockey more than any other sport. Baseball, clearly an individual sport based on individual statistics. Basketball, a very individual sport. Football, clearly a team sport, but I've covered the NFL longer than I've covered the NHL. And I will say that the ethos, the team ethos, the code, the loyalty, all those things matter to hockey more than any other sport I've been around. You know, this is the culture where you're not allowed to step on the logo in the locker room, even though it's right there on the floor as a part of the carpet. Heaven forbid you step on that logo, though, right?
Right, right.
Those are the things that matter in hockey. And you have these gatekeepers with the Hockey Hall of Fame who are the bastions. You know, they are the ones who decide about the game's honor and the game's glory. And here it was Alexander Mogilny, who way too many times over the course of his very magnificent career acted as though he were bigger than the game. He was lazy. He didn't show up some nights. He would, early in his career, you know, maybe not show up to practice or not show up to games. He had this infamous fear of flying in which he seemed to decide that he was okay to fly on non-game days, but on game days it was a problem. I mean, there's all kinds of things in which, you know, I think he cheated the game. He cheated himself. He cheated the organization. And yes, you can take a look at the stats and the volume of them. But I think along the way, he violated team and sports and the things that everyone holds dear about sports and the beauty of sport. He thumbed his nose at it. And I think that there are enough people on the selection committee who remember that. And that's all it takes.
You know, you look at his numbers, even when he first shows up to Vancouver, he gets that 55-goal season. Eventually, you know, there's a holdout, and he eventually wants out of Vancouver, similarly to what happened in Buffalo. But, you know, one of the things from his days in Vancouver and talking to players who've been mostly, like, positive, but you know, the one common refrain I've heard from talking to ex-teammates of Alex Mogilny is, he's the most talented player I ever played with, you know, and yeah. That kind of speaks to what we're talking about here, Tim, in that this guy was among the most talented players that's maybe ever played the game. And who knows what he could have accomplished had he applied that night in, night out. But he didn't have that same drive we see most other greats of the game have.
That's right. And I think that's the line that people find themselves falling on either side of. Is it unfair to punish somebody or to keep him out of the Hall of Fame because he was so good? You know, is he a victim of his own success? And is that his fault that he wasn't otherworldly more often than the one season? I mean, we can take a look at his career and see, yes, he eclipsed 50 goals, which is a hallowed mark in hockey. But a lot of guys get to 50 goals and aren't in the Hall of Fame. You know, it happens. You know, Rick Vive hit 50 goals a bunch. So, yes, he had one magnificent season. And anytime you see the case made for Alexander Mogilny, so much weight is put on that one season. And I think that what people who were then around him for the next 15 years of his career wanted that again. Now, again, is it fair for him? I think those who don't believe he should be in the Hall of Fame yet, maybe they're just making him wait. But those who don't believe he's in the Hall of Fame yet, take a look at it and say, it's his own fault he didn't do that more often. He was an otherworldly talent and in some ways cheated the game of his greatness. So I know that's a conundrum. I mean, he got to decide how much of the game he gave of himself, or how much of himself he gave to the game, I should say. And I think that should what he did give be enough? And I think some people have a hard time just digesting that he didn't dedicate himself. He didn't commit himself, that he had these skills, whereas other guys maybe had to, had to fight a little harder to maximize it and maximize what they had to give, and to see what he have and not care, I think is again, that's the line. Did he give enough, or should he be punished for not giving his all?
Well, and I think, you know, what's really fascinating about this is, and we see it already throughout this conversation in our text inbox about, like, these are not good enough reasons to keep him out. And it's like you said, you would have him in the Hall of Fame. We would have him in the Hall of Fame. But this is how hockey views these things. The committee, you mentioned the gatekeepers of the game. These are the things that do matter to him. This is the criteria that they go through, and this is one of the reasons why he's not in. So it goes beyond the numbers, right? Because we've seen other guys have numbers that aren't quite as good, but they're known as great teammates, showed up at the right time. They did all the other things that the gatekeepers give a lot of value to, so to speak, right? But these are things that just are not as valued as much if you're not bringing it off the ice as well. And I wonder, too, that year he won the Stanley Cup, and you kind of wrote about it, he only had one goal through 20 games. He wasn't as good in the playoffs as he was in the regular season. So even there's a sense that, whether you think it's fair or not, that people thought he wasn't a good enough playoff performer either.
Yeah, you know, so the selectors, they have the job. That's their job is to box out sentimentality. They are the ones, they're the arbiters. They're the ones who get to decide. So you're right. We can look at these reasons why he's not in and say they're not good enough, but we don't get to decide. And these men do. And probably when enough of them leave the committee or die, or another generation of selectors get in 10, 20 years from now, you know, Alexander McGillney's career is looked at a little bit differently, but these are people who covered it, who coached him there. You know, I mentioned it. There are people that you would assume would be allies of Alexander McGillney have been on this committee before. Doc Emrick, you know, the longtime New Jersey Devils broadcaster who wrote a memoir and didn't mention Alexander McGillney once. I mean, this was the guy who, you know, broadcast the Devils winning the cup. You know, this was a pretty big deal, right? Well, McGillney didn't make a blip with him or Pat Quinn or Brian Burke or Igor Larionov or, you know, all these different people that have been able to be of note and not be able to make the case for McGillney. You know, you mentioned the playoffs. You know, there are a lot of things that get mentioned about McGillney that you can quibble with. You know, there was one ESPN piece. It was a mini column. It wasn't in depth. But three of the major reasons for getting him in, should, in addition to the 76-goal season, was he's a member of the Triple Gold Club. He won a Lady Bing. He's on the Stanley Cup. And he was a captain. He was the first Russian-born captain. That's kind of like feathering the nest for me. I mean, the Triple Gold Club, ask the average hockey fan what that even is. I mean, it includes the double IHF championship, which people roll their eyes at, right? It's the championship for the guys who can't make it into the NHL postseason. 34 members of this Triple Gold Club, and over half of them aren't in it. The Lady Bing, which he, you know, it wasn't because he was sticking his nose in traffic, you know, that he won the Lady Bing later in his career. The Stanley Cup, third line winger, trade deadline acquisition, didn't do much in the playoffs. It was a PR stunt when the Sabres made him the captain. Pat LaFontaine was injured, so they make McGillney the first, what they thought was the first Russian-born captain in NHL history, which isn't even true. There was one in the 30s, but it was considered a failure. A big, you know, they were trying to motivate him. They were trying to get him to do all those things that they wanted him to do, and putting a C on him, like we've seen with a lot of players over the years, put the C on him, and then he's going to step up his game. It didn't work. So there are so many things that you can look at as reasons why. And really what it comes back to is defecting from the Soviet Union, being a trailblazer in that regard, one transcendent season, and then volume statistics, in which a lot of people look at it and say, well, injuries robbed him of the ability to reach 500 goals or 1,000 NHL games, et cetera, et cetera. But really, there are a lot of ways he robbed himself. Not his willingness not to train, contract holdouts, missing games here or there, just deciding not to, you know, give his best on a nightly basis. So I think that the people who are critical of him look at those things and not, oh man, if not for those hips, he would have had 600 goals.
Tim, we really appreciate the time. It's you know, for a conversation that for a lot of us, when we've had it, it seemed like a slam dunk. You've brought a lot of, valid, question marks to Almo's case. We'll see if he does end up getting in. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
There is Tim Graham from the Athletic Buffalo joining us and, providing reporting on the situation. It's, it's kind of like a lot of things. It's almost like playing armchair GM a little bit, Sat, where I think he should be in. You think he should be in. Josh thinks he should be in. Tim thinks he should be in. But you know who doesn't think he should be in? The people that are making the call on the Hall of Fame committee.
Well, and this is the entire point that he's trying to make, and people are getting upset about it. It's like, well, he's not saying this. He's saying he would put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But these are the reasons the selectors are not putting him into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And these are the things that happened in his career that people look at negatively.
Yes.
You know, whether we, again, I think he should be in. You think he should be in. Tim thinks he should be in, right? But these are the arguments that are used against him. So when people say, I don't know why this is happening to McGillney, these are the reasons why. Now, you can obviously disagree with the reasons and disagree that this is happening to him. But to the point, because I know Raymond's texting in about it, too, others are as well. He was over a point per game in the regular season, had over 1,000 points in 990 games or whatever it was. He had 86 points in the playoffs, 124 games.
Yeah.
So there was a big discrepancy between how prolific he was in the regular season versus the playoffs, right? And we know those things matter, and it gets used against him, you know? Again, I remember watching McGillney being really impressed by him in the playoffs, and I like a lot of things, but these are the reasons why, and I think you can have your opinion. Again, I think you should be in. But I thought it was a good piece to kind of remind everybody, especially those that maybe weren't watching as much or as closely or remember as much from back in the 90s, what occurred over the course of his career. And the thing, too, he said a lot of people that really backed him and loved him didn't go to the wall for him when they had the chance.
And it's, that is telling to a certain extent. McGillney has essentially been absent from the game since he retired. Not that that should matter in your quest for the Hall of Fame, but this comes down to what those that are making this call ultimately feel. And for all of us that sit here and think it should be a slam dunk, well, maybe it should be a slam dunk, especially with the defection from the USSR and how that essentially changed the entire outlook of the National Hockey League and how players came into the NHL, how many started to defect, and how Russian players elevated essentially the level of play to the best league in the world once they started to become regular parts of the NHL. Alex McGillney is a big part of that, but ultimately, these are the reasons, and Tim Graham is laying them all out for you to see and to understand why this player, whose case seems like a slam dunk, isn't quite the slam dunk that you think it is, even if it's for a lot of superficial reasons.
Yeah, super, and the thing is, when it comes to the Hall of Fame and the people that decide the Hall of Fame, character is a big part of that component.
No, I think it's like on their like list of criteria for getting into the Hall.
Now, I see people to like Rager says, would you rather take prime Roenick or prime McGillney? Like, I think McGillney was a more talented player. Roenick was no slouch. Like, it's really funny if you watch Roenick towards the end of his career and go watch what he did early in his career. Like, he was fast, dynamic, talented. Like, he was a real incredible hockey player. So I don't want to diminish.
Him and Tony Amane were, like, an unbelievable watch.
They were incredible to watch the Blackhawks back in the day, right?
Good Italian boy, Tony
Amane. I knew you'd bring that up. But I love them. Tony Amane was fantastic, right? But I think McGillney was a better player. And I think Roenick was a very me person, but he was considered a great teammate.
Yeah.
Guys loved him.
Yeah.
You know, he played hard. I mean, he blocked shots with his face and came back the next shift with no teeth in his mouth and blocked shots again, and very Rick Tocchet-like in how he played, right, was physical. He was considered a great teammate, a great leader. Would he have too much fun at times? Yes, but I don't think hockey people mind that as long as you show up and play hard, and that's kind of what Roenick was. His reputation was better. I agree. I'd rather have McGillney than Roenick, and that's not diminishing Roenick. But it comes down to the character component.
Yeah.
And Roenick is viewed far differently than the way McGillney is viewed. Can you say some of that is biased and that McGillney was also a bit misunderstood because of where he came from? And if he was coming into a more welcoming environment where you could maybe try to reach him as opposed to be like, what's wrong with this weirdo?
Yeah.
Would you view him differently? And I think there is a level of misunderstanding that people should take responsibility for and not just, you know, look at him and say, you know, why is he acting this way? But these are the reasons why. And again, like, I think he should absolutely be in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
I hope he does get in eventually. And all this conversation was about was to showcase some of the reasons as to why it's not, as I said earlier, the slam dunk that most of us think it is. And to highlight those. And we may not agree with them. I don't agree with a lot of the way that the Hall of Fame goes about their process, but it is their process, and it's been this way for a long time. I don't see them changing anytime soon. And that's the way that it's going to be. Jeremy Roenick's speech, though, was pretty great last night for those that did watch it or hear it. There's some great tidbits in there, and you know, you could tell the way he spoke of Doug Wilson giving him a job in San Jose was pretty touching. Like, it essentially saved his life. Literally saved my life is how Jeremy Roenick put it. And it was a touching speech. It was a good one to send off the night evening.
I remember, so long story short, there was a former teammate of his that I knew.
Yeah.
And I knew the person he was dating really well.
Ah.
And I remember hearing stories about Jeremy Roenick and how much fun he was, but also, like, how he's one of those guys that, like, you would just, like, be like, hey, we're going to Vegas. Who wants to come along? And you get guys that weren't making as much money go, and they'd be spending way more than they should. They'd be like, what are we doing hanging out with Jeremy Roenick? But it's like, you wanted to hang out with them, right? Yeah. You wanted to be around JR because he was so much fun. And guys would, like, go and, you know, burn their paychecks because they wanted to go to Vegas for a weekend with him. And this guy was telling me, he's like, I'm on a league minimum contract. And my girlfriend's like, what are you doing? Like, you can't afford to do this. But it's like, how many times am I going to be able to party with Jeremy Roenick in Vegas?
Yeah, not many. It's pretty incredible. So we'll see what happens with the next call to the Hall. But last night, we saw a great class go in, including one of my favorite players through the 2000s, Pavel Datsyuk. Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah coming up. Frank Saravalli, he was at the Hall of Fame induction last night in Toronto. He'll join us, his take on how the trade market is developing and more. That's coming up next on Canuck Central. Back in on Canuck Central, it's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. Here at Rogers Arena, Canucks and Calgary Flames getting set for puck drop here tonight. 650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. You want to be a part of the program, you can. Always appreciate those listening live on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox jumping in to join the show. All right, let's bring in our next guest. It is Frank Saravalli, our weekly NHL insider. What's happening, Frank? How are you?
I'm good. How you doing, boys?
We're doing pretty well. I know you were at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony last night. We were just talking with Tim Graham of The Athletic, who did a good piece on maybe some of the reasons why Alex McGillney isn't quite in yet. But it's it is always interesting when you think about the different, you know, the way that the Hall of Fame goes about their business. There's always been a question mark of Alex McGillney. I mean, we see and remember how good of a player he was, but sometimes you're not just judged on what you did on the ice.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. And I would also say that the one thing about the Hockey Hall of Fame that I think they don't get enough credit for is that, for the most part, they get it right. And even if they don't get it right the first time, they find a way to adapt. And I think some recent examples, Eric Lindros is a great one. He was quite clearly a Hall of Fame talent player. His career was short, but his numbers stacked up better than someone like Cam Neely of a similar career length and career arc. But for a long time was kept out, partly due to some off-ice stuff and partly due to just sort of how outspoken he was also, I think, on concussions. And, like, sometimes these guys are a bit ahead of their time. And in McGillney's case, I think there's probably a proper, I would say, adjustment that needs to be made in scoring era, in how much more difficult it was to score just to stack his numbers up alongside some others. And so there also should probably be a conversation about, you know, certainly some cultural differences that might exist. Like, there's just a lot to it. Nothing is really as simple as it sounds. And I understand where they're at. I understand that he certainly wasn't a first ballot guy. And I'm also okay if he's not in. Like, the fact that we're talking about him every year is a testament to the career that he had.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we'll see ultimately if he does get in down the road here. And, you know, one guy that really stole the show with how emotional his speech was Jeremy Roenick. And, Frank, like, you're an American. Obviously, Jeremy Roenick, an American player. And, you know, people will kind of compare McGillney and Roenick, and even though Roenick played more games and had more points, but, you know, quality of player, and say, well, you can make the case that McGillney was better. But as far as how Roenick is viewed and how Roenick was also a big star for American hockey players and American fans, like, how much of an impact did JR really make in the States when he was playing?
Well, I just think it's not all that different of a conversation too, because JR waited a while, in part because he was outspoken, in part because he rubbed some people the wrong way. At times he was a bigger focus because of how, he wasn't afraid to speak out on topics, and at times, even in his TV career, wasn't afraid to say some things that ultimately ended up getting him in trouble and costing him his job. Like, that was a conversation that needed to be had, that, again, going back to what I was saying about them rectifying some potential past mistakes, they do come around to it. And part of it is because the selection committee also evolves, right? There's, you know, we just saw two new announcements today, appointments, Jerome Iginla and Ed Olczyk, that join the 18-member committee, and there are term limits. There are people that are constantly shuffled in and out, that there's new voices, new debates, new points of view. And when it comes to Jeremy Roenick, like, I also saw him up close and personal and how big of a star he was in his time in Philadelphia. I mean, 3 years and the points, certainly, and numbers aren't eye-popping, but when it came time to scoring a massive goal in a playoff series against the Toronto Maple Leafs, he was a guy that just seemed to always stand up and be counted. So he was always in the limelight, and that probably cost him a bit, but this is also a really talented player that played for a really long time.
So switching focus to some things happening today, Lars Eller gets traded from Pittsburgh to Washington. The Penguins still reeling from their 7-1 loss to the Dallas Stars last night. And there was a report out of Pittsburgh saying everybody is available in trade outside of Sidney Crosby. And then next thing you know, Lars Eller is getting traded. Are we starting to see a trade market essentially develop here as some teams are really off to tough starts?
We are and aren't. Like, I know that sounds like a cop-out answer, but I talked to Kevin Adams today, the GM of the Buffalo Sabres, after the GM meetings, and I was saying, like, the longer this goes on for your team, are you ultimately going to be pressed into doing something? And he said, as much as I'd like to do something, it still takes two teams to do it, and not everyone is in that mode. It's not as if the Pittsburgh Penguins sending a massive wake-up call to the rest of their team today. It's not like the Penguins are coming to the rescue for the Buffalo Sabres. If you're Buffalo, you're going, how are any of these guys really going to help our team get better right in the here and now? And so I think that's kind of part of the problem, is as much as a couple teams might be really interested or intrigued to do something, and we talked last week about how bad of a fit two teams like the Canucks and Sabres would be as trade partners, that there's also this other part of it that Buffalo is grappling with, I think, that involves you have to give to get. And if you're plucking someone off your roster, especially a roster that young, you better make sure you get it right in terms of who you say goodbye to.
Well, and I think that's the other big part of it too. Teams are also very, very afraid of making moves and being, you know, wrong on a player too early, especially a team laden with a bunch of young players. And you know, the other part of that, you know, the Capitals trade, as much as you're right, I'm not sure if this is the beginning, so to speak, either, because the Capitals have a lot of LTIR space to absorb a contract worth $2.45 million. And right now, absorbing money seems like a very complicated thing to do. Like, even for the Canucks, they're trying to accrue cap space, so they have $5-6 million at the deadline, mm-hmm. but they don't have the $5-6 million today to make an acquisition.
There's really only, like, I don't know, maybe 10 teams, maybe 12 in the league that would even be able to make a deal like that today. I think that's actually it. There's no more than that. And the Penguins, who didn't really have much cap space to begin with, now get a little bit of breathing room. So you send a shot across the bow, and you get waxed. You're down 6-0 in the first period for the first time ever in franchise history, which is kind of amazing because there were some really, really bad Penguins teams in the 80s and also in the 2000s to start that led them to Evgeny Malkin, Sidney Crosby, and Marc-Andre Fleury. So the fact that they set a record last night is noteworthy in and of itself. But from a pure transactional standpoint, let's say the Penguins wanted to go make a bigger move. To do something like that, you'd have to unload a piece like Lars Eller's first.
Yeah, you got to open up some space in order to get something done. And, you know, it is interesting, you know, the way things went down in Pittsburgh before they hired Kyle Dubas. It wasn't looking good. And I'm not sure there's much Dubas could have done to – you know, fix the Penguins. I don't know if they were fixable when he took over the team, right? But I don't think anything he has done has helped their situation. Spending the cap space on Carlson, some of the contracts he doled out in that first offseason, it feels like Dubas's attempts to get the Penguins back into contention, it doesn't feel like it hasn't done what he was hoping for.
No, in fact, I think it's actually taken them in the wrong direction. Feels like the shine has worn off the boy genius, the bright young, up and coming. This is the next Theo Epstein of the NHL. That's what Fenway Sports Group believed they were hiring when they gave him a mostly unprecedented contract as general manager. And the reason they did that is because it was such a tough job to take given their current roster scenario. But when you take a roster that's been tripled down on and then you quadruple down mm-hmm. and compound your own issues, trading your first round pick to get Erik Karlsson when he's not what that team needed, and then, you know, spin it with some other contracts like this Eller one that he signed multiple years, They've gone in the absolute wrong direction. And the trouble for the Penguins is they're already in the bottom five in the NHL in points percentage this year. And this is only like the very beginning of the pain for a team that's already missed the playoffs 2 years in a row. And beyond that, hasn't won a single playoff round since 2018. It's been a long time. So it certainly feels like, as you look at the Pittsburgh Penguins through the lens of an hourglass, like we're down to some of the last grains of sand here.
Well, absolutely. And when we hear stuff like everybody's available outside of Sidney Crosby, I mean, I always kind of roll my eyes about that stuff because ultimately, you know, they're not going to trade everybody. But could we get to a point where actually we see a guy like Evgeny Malkin or even Chris Letang get moved this season?
You have to ask them that. They all have full no move clauses. Mm-hmm. Like, if they don't want to go anywhere, they don't have to. And that's another contributing factor to all of this is it'd be one thing if you wanted to offload these guys, and I don't even know if ownership would let them, but even if that were to happen, would they say yes? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe. But, you know, I wanted to mention one thing, too, because I was thinking about it as we moved on to the Penguins. We were talking about the trade market and how things develop. And Kevin Adams, and this isn't me criticizing Kevin Adams at all, you can read the full piece tomorrow. I just wanted to mention that one of the things that I really admired about the Canucks, as we hear a lot of different, I don't want to say excuses, but the Canucks are like the one team in the last 12 to 14 months that has been able to say, oh, not normally the right time of year to trade. We're going to do it. Don't have cap space. We'll find someone to offload our deals. Nothing else is happening in the marketplace. We'll change that. Like, there's like the one refreshing team that their front office is just like, yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. Whatever it takes, we're going to make this team better. And we're not going to sit around and wait for a market to develop that may never develop or may never be what we want it to be. We're going to go out and pursue our own thing. And I think that's been an incredibly powerful statement to the rest of the league in this period of time when you hear a lot of other conversations about how difficult it is to make a deal.
Well, and even last week, you know, doing good by a player, I guess, you know, things aren't working out for Daniel Sprong and they immediately move him on to the Seattle Kraken. Don't even take anything back in return. Just give it out to a division rival. And
because it helps.
Yeah.
It helps the crew cap space in the end. And it was square peg in a round hole. They tried it. And I've said this since the moment he walked in the door, hired as president of hockey ops with Jim Rutherford. If they try something and it doesn't work, he's never, ever, ever afraid to say, hey, sorry, we made a mistake here. We're going to fix it.
Yeah, and he's done that on a couple of occasions. Even Curtis Lazar a couple of years ago quickly moved on after it wasn't working. And, you know, he's been in New Jersey ever since. The Canucks are we're going to see Jonathan Lekkerimäki's debut here tonight. The rookie, 15th overall pick from a couple of years ago, obviously trying to fill the big boots left by Brock Besser, who's out with the injury suffered from the hits last week by Tanner Jeannot. And, you know, anytime a big-time prospect comes up, there's a lot of expectation. Certainly there's going to be no different here with Lekkerimäki. And, you know, I guess for me, one of the other things it kind of tells us is the Canucks don't view this guy as a trade piece, because if you thought Jonathan Lekkerimäki was going to be somebody that helps you make a big acquisition at the deadline, you probably keep him in Abbotsford for the time being.
I've never viewed him as a trade piece. I think the Canucks front office has consistently been a believer and been high on him. In fact, so much so to the point where I thought there was a real chance, I can remember being excited walking to the rink during the playoffs for a morning skate, being like, I think Lekkerimäki is playing tonight. Like, I think they were in a spot where it was on their radar. Obviously, that didn't happen, and it's a big bridge of trust that needs to be built between player and coach to be thrown into a situation like that, and probably wasn't ready. But the fact that he was even on the radar is probably a pretty strong indication of what they think of him. And he's proven in very, very limited time in Abbotsford that he can do more. And I'm fascinated to see what that looks like. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, we're all excited to see it. And I know Canucks fans are very, very geeked up. And, you know, he had a tremendous year last year, too, in Sweden, and even showed well in a cup of coffee with the Abbotsford Canucks, and obviously been red hot so far this year. And as far as, you know, another situation, and, you know, we get this question all the time from Canucks fans. Anytime a player gets mentioned on the trade market or a young player that perhaps hasn't established himself yet, and, you know, the Columbus Blue Jackets have been going through their turmoil, you know, in many ways, the past few years, of course. And, you know, Derek Yiricek is a player that was drafted sixth overall a couple years ago, but it hasn't really gone as well for him, and we kind of wonder what's going to happen next. They have a new GM in charge. Even if David Yiricek was available for trade, how high do you think the cost would be, considering he's still only 20 years old?
I would say pretty high. The Blue Jackets, I think, have fumbled the bag in terms of his career management to this point. I think he has shown more than enough to already be a staple in their top four. I think he was jerked around last year by their coaching staff, shuttled back and forth with management position approval between Cleveland and Columbus, and some of that probably shouldn't have happened, should have been nipped in the bud. And now they've got a guy who is really, really talented that hasn't been able to show it and is probably also at the same time a little bit frustrated with how things have played out, and understandably so. I think it was supposed to be a fresh start this year, and I think the surprise has been that he hasn't been more regularly featured and been given more big minutes to really show what he has, because he doesn't really have anything left to prove in the AHL, but there's not really any sense that it makes for the Columbus Blue Jackets to move on from a piece like that.
So you mentioned the GM meetings today. What were the big topics on hand?
So it was really, to give you kind of a rapid-fire overview of the meeting, is a lot of talk and no action.
Yep.
One of the big parts of it was discussion about the NCAA rule change and as it relates to the CHL, which we've all been kind of talking about the last 10 days or so. Mm-hmm. But no one really knows yet how that's going to impact even the NHL. There's some theories and thoughts, but there's a lot of work to do. From an on-ice standpoint, there was an update on cut-resistant equipment, and I thought it was fascinating to me that the league has kept close tabs on it, and so far only 55 out of 708 skaters have been wearing a neck guard. That was part of the update. They're continuing to push that for players to get educated and wear this equipment that's available to them. They began to poll and canvas GMs on what changes they'd like to potentially make to the CBA as they're gearing up for CBA talks with the NHLPA. We're talking about things like, hey, could there be further term limits placed on contracts? Could we be shortening them down to a maximum of, 5 years or something? Do GMs want LTIR handled differently? Do they want a salary cap in the playoffs? So they began to have some discussions and updates on that. They did set a date for the draft in late June, decentralized, confirmed, and likely to take place from a made-for-TV perspective in LA, and just a host of other sort of smaller updates that came out as well.
What do you think the odds are that they can actually work out a new CBA by, say, before next season begins?
Man, I'd love to handicap that. I don't think we know enough yet to be able to really say that with any degree of certainty, because
I mean, I'd love to see it, right? For once, the NHL getting ahead of it and not going down to the wire.
Please let that happen.
Yeah, as some guy who has spent way too much time on New York street corners covering lockouts in my career, I'd like to never do that again. And yeah, I've done it in all seasons, like sweating in the summer and absolutely freezing in the winter. I think it would be the best move possible for the game. My fear is that the NHL believes that relations with the NHLPA are so comfortable, the best that they've ever been, according to the league, that perhaps they're underestimating Marty Walsh, that they don't necessarily have a good sense of what he's going to be like to be across the table from and what the players are going to ask for. So I think until we get a better view of that, I can't really say for sure.
We'll see what happens. And before we let you go, we have one more thing I want to ask you, and it's about the Habs. They've obviously got off to not the start they wanted to, and they wanted to be in the mix a bit more, but you know, they're going to get to a point where they're going to have to make some tough decisions. Where do you think they're going to be at as far as being a seller, and could they be an interesting team, especially with a guy like Mike Matheson, who could be one of the best defensemen on the market if they're willing to trade him, and with a nice contract that's under $5 million this year and next?
Yeah, I think there's probably not enough of an appreciation for Mike Matheson and his game. Last year, 62 points. He was in the top 20 among all defensemen in scoring, and he's sub $5 million, to your point. Like, I don't know that people fully appreciated the year that he had. That said, the Canadiens' blue line is already thin, and they're actually looking to add, if possible, a top four defenseman. I know things have gone the wrong way this year, and they're trying to stabilize that if they can. They're a believer in the young pieces that they have coming. Reinbacher, Logan Mailloux, Lane Hudson. Like, those are all key important pieces for the future. The question is, can they bridge the gap better between now and then? And if so, does it make sense to throw potential future assets at a piece that might only be there for a couple years?
Frank, we appreciate the time as always. Thanks for this.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy the game.
There is Frank Saravalli joining us from the GM meetings in Toronto as some interesting topics on hand, including term limits to contracts, maybe lowering from 8 years. It's something we've mentioned on the show here in the last couple of years, actually, Sat.
Yeah, and I mean, do we see 7-6 instead? So 6 years is the most you can get in free agency, but a team can re-sign a player up to 7 years instead of 7-8. But for that to happen, the NHL is going to have to give the PA something.
Yeah.
You know, so what is that going to be? Do you get the free agency year sooner? Right now it's 7 years or 20, you know, or 27.
Yeah.
Do you bring that down to 26 and perhaps 6 years, depending on? Because you have to give the PA something if you want the term limits.
Yeah, and we've seen it. I mean, basketball does 4 years and 5 years. They've also got a lot of other different stipulations with their contracts, the Supermax and all those different kinds of things.
Yeah.
But we'll see, because 8 years has always felt long. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how that develops over the course of the year. All right, it's a game day, so you know what that means. $4 Big Mac Day. It's time to celebrate the return of hockey season with McDonald's Canada's Game Day Deals. Canucks Central gives you the chance to win a $100 McDonald's gift card that you can use to get a Big Mac, McChicken, or Filet-O-Fish Game Day deal for just $4 plus tax on any Canucks home or away game day this season. Only through the McDonald's app. Download the McDonald's app to score great deals and earn McDonald's, my McDonald's rewards towards free McDonald's. We give you a trivia question. You answer it, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Pretty simple. Here is today's question. Two players in the Canucks organization played for Orebro, or as Sat would say,
Orebro,
of the SHL last season. Jonathan Lekromäki was one. Who was the other? Answer it, 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. That's Orebro, or to properly say it,
Orebro.
There we go. Who was the other one? Not Jonathan Lekromäki, the other player that played for
Orebro
last season.
Yeah.
We'll come back with the answer, and you'll hear from Rick Tocchet next on Sportsnet 650.